From KALW and PRX, this is Inflection Point, stories of how women rise up. I'm Lauren Schiller.
My brother is a gay man, and my mother asked him that first day, what are the chances? What are the chances that I have a gay son and a transgender child? And my hope was that she could end up asking that question, what are the chances, not out of pity, but out of pride, out of awe in the fact that they had raised three children, two of whom are LGBTQ and had the courage to come out, out of awe in the beauty and the diversity of our family that I think has made us a better family, a stronger family, a more compassionate family. And I think one of the most incredible things in this journey is seeing my parents go from that place of sort of self-pity in my identity to pride in my identity.
When Sarah McBride came out to her family as transgender at age 21, it was the hardest thing she'd ever had to do. While her family was still processing this a few months in, she posted a note on social media about her true gender identity.
I wrote that note for a couple reasons. The first was, I was student body president at American University at the time, and I knew that my coming out would be something that people would talk about. And I also knew that if I could get it out in my own words, on my own terms, if I could try to humanize my experience a little bit more for people, that maybe it would reduce the potential bullying or mockery that might come my way.
But Sarah also approached her coming out process fully aware that her mostly positive experience wasn't the norm for most transgender people.
Coming out was the hardest thing that I had ever done up until that point, but it was still relatively easy compared to the experience of so many other people. And so I wanted to make sure that I could help contribute to making a world where it's not a privilege to be safe from violence. It's not a privilege to be accepted and loved by your family. It's not a privilege to still have economic opportunities and educational opportunities in front of you.
In 2016, Sarah McBride made history and a childhood dream come true when she stood on stage as the first transgender person to speak at a national political convention. The Democratic National Convention, the same stage that Hillary Clinton accepted her nomination.
My name is Sarah McBride, and I am a proud transgender American.
Sarah's been on the ground as well, fighting for trans equality. She was instrumental in getting her home state of Delaware to adopt its first equality bill.
I had always done advocacy from this perspective of advocating for others. And this was, in many ways, my first experience sort of directly advocating for myself.
And in the most challenging moments, the 2016 election results, everyday sexism and misogyny, and the death of her young husband, even then, she fights to update our laws to protect and include LGBTQ people. Sarah is now the National Press Secretary at the Human Rights Campaign, the nation's largest LGBTQ civil rights organization. And she's the author of the new book, Tomorrow Will Be Different, Love, Loss, and the Fight for Trans Equality.
My voice isn't just powerful, my voice doesn't just matter, but I, as an LGBTQ person, am powerful by just being, by living. And that is a power we carry with us from the scariest of spaces to the safest of places.
We started our conversation discussing one of her core beliefs, that LGBTQ equality translates to equality for everyone.
You know, I think one of the most important things is to understand the point that Audre Lorde said, which is that there's no such thing as a single issue struggle because no one lives single issue lives. And if we only pursue equality with respect to specifically sexual orientation and gender identity, then we're going to leave far too many people, not just in our own community, but in the world behind. The LGBTQ community is as diverse as the fabric of this country. We are as diverse as humanity. We are people of color. We're disabled people. We're women. We're Muslim. We're immigrants. And so we have to make sure in everything that we do that we're recognizing the importance of intersectionality, the importance of making change on all fronts, because if we don't, we're going to only make change for the most privileged. And that's why as a movement launched in response to police violence at the Stonewall Inn. We must always say that Black Lives Matter. It's why, as a community that saw so many members die at Pulse, that we must work to combat the scourge of gun violence in this country. It's why when this president tries to rip healthcare away from millions of Americans, including those living with HIV, that we fight back and we work to not just protect healthcare, but expand access to healthcare. And so it's incredibly important to recognize that we need change on all fronts. We need change now, and that we should be working across identities and across coalitions to make sure that we're standing in solidarity with one another and bringing change for everyone in the community.
So what does equality mean to you?
To me, it's a broad term. I think I try to think of justice. I try to think of equity. I try to think of making sure that we're ensuring that one, every person can live as much of their life as possible to the fullest, to make sure that no one has to fear discrimination or violence, to make sure that people are provided opportunities to pursue their dreams. And I think at the end of the day, we need to build a world where everyone has the freedom from fear of discrimination or violence, where everyone understands that they are beautiful, that they are worthy, and that they should be treated with respect, dignity, and fairness in every aspect of their life.
That seems like something that every human should get behind or would get behind. Like, it just seems like such a no-brainer. So what is standing in our way? Like, why would there be opposition to that?
Well, I think for a couple different reasons. I think so often we inherit outdated dogmas and outdated positions, whether it's from our parents, whether it's in society, whether it's in our churches or houses of worship. You know, one of the things that I learned in dealing with bullies and harassment online is that everyone deals with an insecurity or something that society has told them they should be ashamed of. It's not just their sexual orientation or gender identity, but it can be so many other things. And one of the things that I realized in my own life and in my own work is that as LGBTQ people, we have accepted that's something that society has told us we should be ashamed of, and not only accepted that, but in many cases moved forward with pride in ourselves. And the bullies and those who hate, I think in many cases, they see that. They see that power and they're jealous of it. They see that agency and they're jealous of it. And so I think in many cases, that's where it comes from. I think it comes from fear of the unknown. I think it comes from the fear of if we continue to accept the beautiful diversity of the society, then maybe they might have to grapple with something that they're struggling with. And I certainly want to build a world where everyone can grapple with that and take pride in themselves and love themselves.
For you, it seems like you're okay with that. You came out on Facebook and you were so clear in what you wanted to say about who you are.
Well, it took 21 years for me to figure that out, and in many cases, 21 yeah. years to write that note. But I think for me, I wrote that note for a couple of reasons. The first was I was student body president at American University at the time, and I knew that my coming out would be something that people would talk about. I also felt like I had a responsibility as student body president to use what little platform I had to try to educate people a little bit more about what it means to be transgender, what it's like to be transgender, about my own experience. And again, recognizing both that my experience is not a universal experience, that I also come to this experience and journey with a lot of privileges, but to use that platform as much as possible to try to demonstrate that behind this conversation are real people who love and laugh, hope and fear, dream and cry, just like everyone else. And so I wrote that note, I posted it, and then I posted it in the school newspaper, and the response was truly incredible on campus. I mean, it was nothing but support. But it was also clear to me through that the experience that I had, in large part because of my privileges, in large part because of my position as student body president, was not the reality for far too many transgender people around that campus and certainly around this world. And so that's why I got involved in advocacy, was because in large part that experience of coming out was so overwhelmingly positive, but still so difficult. And if it was difficult for me, then I can't imagine having to do it without the support and the love that I had.
Before you announced publicly that you were a transgender woman, you were kind of gathering support of a smaller group, right? Like you told your parents ahead of that. So they didn't just open the paper one day and find out.
Right. Yeah. it wasn't news to them when they logged on to Facebook, right? Or my mom logged on to Facebook.
So how did you approach that conversation with them? And what did it take for you to just finally tell them?
Well, you know, for so long, I had tried to compartmentalize my identity. I tried to tell myself that if I could make a difference in this world, if I could make my family proud, that those things would somehow bring me the wholeness and completeness that I sought. And it was through my experience, I think, at American University as student body president, getting to advocate on a number of issues, including LGBTQ issues, that I saw that those things wouldn't bring me the wholeness and the fulfillment that I thought. And it became something, my gender identity became something I thought about every single waking hour of every single day. And in the fall semester of my junior year, while I was serving as student body president, I confided in a dear friend, Helen, who was studying abroad in South Africa at the time. And I think the fact that they were so far away and we were talking on GChat, it felt a little bit sort of removed, and I felt a little bit more comfortable sharing that I was struggling with my gender identity. And Helen responded with nothing but love and support. And I think that one experience for me was transformative, because I always knew Helen would be incredibly supportive there, as my friends called, a walking, bleeding heart. but because they responded without batting an eye, it became so clear to me that my world wouldn't fall apart. And so with that courage, and I think that sort of realization, I then was able to move forward. And on Christmas Day, I came out to my parents after we opened presents. And when I came out to them, they were very clear just how scared they were.
And they had just presented you with a suit and tie,
right? It was a button-up shirt and a tie, which was such a stark contrast between where I was and where I wanted to be, between who I knew I was and who everyone else thought I was, between the expectations and, again, what I knew they would fear and what I feared, which was that any possibility of professional fulfillment, of being welcomed in my home state, of even finding love, that would all go away with this news. And my mother came up into my bedroom. She asked me, she said, "You seem so down, and you never seem down. What's going on?" I told her that I was just stressed about school or something like that. She went downstairs, and I thought to myself, she just asked you. You have the courage to say it. Go down and tell her. So I went downstairs, and I said, "Mom, I've been thinking a lot about my sexual orientation and gender identity." And I threw in sexual orientation because I knew it was 2011. I knew that she wasn't familiar with that word, with that phrase, that she wouldn't know what was about to come. And I wanted her to know that I was about to come out as something. And I said, "And I've come to the conclusion that I'm transgender." She immediately burst into tears, ran upstairs and to my father. And I came out to then my father and one of my brothers, who responded with, "Well, I always thought you were gay, but I guess this makes sense."
Thanks, bro.
Yeah, seriously. It was like the perfect comment. Perfect comment that encapsulates that brother totally.
Do you think your mom was just shocked, or had seen it coming and it was
definitely? I think she was totally shocked. I think she was scared. I think she was scared about what it would mean for me. I think truthfully, and I think she admitted this, that she was scared about what other people would say about us, about our family.
As a family.
And I think more than anything else, in that moment, she felt a loss. She felt like the child she had always known was dying, as she said. It took my brother, who's a radiation oncologist, to come down from New York that Christmas day. And he said to my mother, "Your child is not dying. They are not going anywhere. You know, this might be difficult, but basically get it together. You're still keeping your child." And I think, you know, I was so patient with my parents. I think it required both my patience, but also my brother sort of coming in and giving my mother some perspective to allow her to begin to move forward.
And do you think your brother had warmed them up at all? I mean, like, how did they react when he came out to them?
They were nothing but supportive when he came out. He came out about 10 years before me. And I think what's clear is that while transphobia and homophobia are rooted in the same prejudice, which is this perception that the sex you are assigned at birth should dictate who you are and who you love, what you do, how you act. That even though these issues are inextricably linked, there are unique challenges that folks who are trans and gender nonconforming face in coming out and in facing this world. My parents, when my brother came out, they had reference points for success. They had reference points for at least gay and lesbian people that they knew of who were happy and fulfilled and had found love and acceptance. But for them, particularly at that time, their reference points for transgender people and identities were either a punchline in a comedy or a dead body in a drama. And they one, didn't have exposure. They didn't have information. They didn't understand what it meant to be transgender. But also, even if they did have that information, they didn't think that there was a path forward. And I think that's one of the best things about our progress is now that there are so many, as Laverne Cox said, possibility models for so many young transgender people who are growing up today who now know that their dreams and their identities aren't mutually exclusive.
I think one of the perceptions around trans people is that they're, you know, they're on the margins and they dress funny and they're like over the top or they're like, you sort of see it in the sort of RuPaul world of just, you know, like cross-dressing and just like being like really out there and, you know, beautiful in so doing, but not sort of like mainstream America.
Right.
Which politics kind of is trying to represent, right?
Right,
or like
right.
be this, you know, something
at
for
least
everyone.
Appeal to, yeah. Right.
So, I mean, you live in D.C., you dress fairly conservatively, like you present like, you know,
right.
a mainstream person. I mean, is that intentional? Is that so you can get more done so people take you seriously? Like, it's just kind of like, how do you want to be perceived?
Well, I think it's an interesting question. I think we're all navigating this world, this imperfect world in imperfect ways. And most days I just wear pajamas to work. I'm like, I go to work and I am basically wearing a hoodie and pajama pants almost. But I think all of us are trying to navigate this world. All of us are trying to figure out the best way to be safe, to be taken seriously. And so, you know, I don't know the degree to which, you know, where I land in my gender expression is a byproduct of this is where I feel comfortable versus this is what I do to navigate the world. It's probably a mix of those things, as I think it is for a lot of people.
Yep.
But I think what we have to do is we have to make sure, and this is one of the things that I always try to do, is that we have to make sure that we're not just building empathy, compassion, and equality and dignity for those who are the most politically palatable or the
right.
most mainstream. We have to make sure that everyone is able to and safe in landing wherever they are in that gender cloud. And, you know, I think so often in this country and in this world, we have compassion for people who are the same as us in every single way but one or two. And what we need, what real compassion is, what real humanity is compassion and empathy for people who are different than you in maybe every single way but one, the fact that you're both humans. And I think recognizing that need and understanding that there might be pain and experiences that are so different than yours that they almost are incomprehensible. But that's when compassion, that's when standing up, that's when fighting back, that's when speaking out, that's when it's most important. This isn't about how we look. This is about who we are. And whether you dress conservatively or whether you don't, whether you dress in traditionally masculine or traditionally feminine ways corresponding with that gender identity or you don't, all of us, transgender or cisgender, should be able to express ourselves, to be ourselves without fear of rejection, without fear of violence, without fear of discrimination. And my goal and my hope is to challenge folks to recognize that, you know, it's one thing, it's easy to have empathy and compassion for someone like me who's a white, younger, economically secure, educated transgender woman who transitioned relatively young. I'm not the person who needs action as much as so many other people. And so my hope, my goal is to make sure that, you know, in writing this book and sharing my own story, that I allow people maybe to enter into my own experience, but that they don't just empathize with me. They don't just feel the need to make sure that I'm treated with dignity and respect and fairness, but rather that every person is.
One of the issues that comes up when discussing feminism and transgender women is the notion of seeing the world from the other side. For those who were raised as boys, do trans women have better insights or advantages into the patriarchal system than cis women? Does growing up perceived as male help trans women to avoid some of the oppressive forces that cis women experience? Sarah McBride grew up presenting as a white guy, but she told me that her experience in the world of white men can't be wrapped up in a tidy little box. That's coming up after the break. I'm Lauren Schiller, and this is Inflection Point. I'm talking with Sarah McBride, author of Tomorrow Will Be Different. What can you share about having been perceived in the world as a white guy for about 20 years that, you know, I mean, you were very successful now, and you were already student government president by the time that you came out. What can you share about that previous experience that all of us could bring into our lives to be successful?
You know, I think it's a conversation I talk quite a bit about. And I think when I was preparing to come out, I was so consumed with the transphobia that would potentially come my way that I didn't, I think, fully recognize just how pervasive and just how significant the sexism and misogyny would be that would come my way that exists in this world. I actually remember having conversations with my friends in high school, trying to do the absolutely absurd endeavor of comparing and ranking oppression, and I don't think I had a full appreciation for just how pervasive sexism and misogyny was. And I think my experience in coming out and transitioning was certainly eye-opening in many ways, and it was eye-opening in with respect to that, in seeing just how much we interact with gender, just how much we interact with sexism and misogyny, just how often our even little decisions are impacted by considerations around sexism and misogyny, whether it's, again, people navigating this world and figuring out what's the right path to take, what should I wear to be taken seriously? I mean, like, the fact that we have to consider all of these things. When before I, as much as I thought about my own gender identity every single waking hour of every single day, I wasn't also thinking about, well, how do I get taken seriously? Or what's the path home that I'm more safe taking? You know, these were considerations that I didn't have to take. I understood how unsafe street harassment might be, but I didn't fully realize just how dehumanizing it would be to have a stranger feel entitled to comment on my body because I had the audacity of just walking down the street by them. You know, these were really eye-opening experiences. And I think that every person's path to who they are is different, right? No two women's path are the same, whether they're both cisgender white women, whether it's a cisgender woman of color and a cisgender white woman, whether it's a transgender woman and a cisgender woman. No two paths are the same. And we all wind our journeys we all go down our paths with different privileges and perspectives, some limiting and others illuminating. And for me, that was a path that I went down that was truly eye-opening. And I think every time I talk to transgender people, their experience is one that I think is a really important aspect of conversations around gender and society and feminism and sexism and misogyny, because it is a unique perspective that I think enhances these conversations. And certainly that's how I feel in my own journey.
Was there a certain level of confidence or male swagger, you know, that you were able to bring with you? I mean, did you ever feel that? Like,
I mean, maybe I think that I think to some degree, I think when I came out, I was so insecure and so nervous that a lot of that washed away. I mean, maybe some of that is still there. You know, I think what's important in this conversation is this. I think there's this perception that when a transgender person is still in the closet and a transgender person is maybe still being perceived as the sex that they're assigned at birth and the gender that they were assigned accordingly, that we assume that their experience is identical to that of, you know, that my experience was identical to a cisgender man's experience. And, you know, I was always a trans woman. I was always a woman. It was something I've known about myself. And throughout that experience, I'm internalizing the sexism and misogyny that I'm seeing in the world, right? Whether that's internalizing that in relation to my own womanhood or whether it's in relation to my transness or both, I'm taking that, I'm seeing that. Whether it's transgender people who are in the closet who are getting bullied for not conforming to the gender binary or gender stereotypes, I think we so often in this conversation think that a transgender person before they come out or before they transition, if they transition, is interacting the world the same as people who aren't transgender. And that's just not the case. And so I think it's difficult to sort of evaluate for me what aspects of society sort of because of socialization I carry with me and what aspects were aspects that I had already internalized. And because it's a confluence of so many different things, you know, my race, my economic background, my you know, able-bodied privilege, all of these different privileges that I carry with me, it's sort of difficult to sort of pull one strand out and identify or isolate that. But also, I think sometimes we have this tendency to isolate trans women doing things that we deem as masculine and go, oh, that must be because they were socialized as a man, when there are cisgender women who might be just as sort of aggressive. I think, you know, so I think we have to get to this place where we can have a conversation where we can recognize that there are some experiences that might have impacted us through socialization, and also not going, oh, every single time a transgender woman does something that we deem as masculine, to go, oh, that was because you were raised as a boy, right? And ending that ends up sort of becoming this asterisk on their gender identity in a way. And then it also results in transgender women, I think, then going, okay, so does that mean that the only way that I can be perceived and affirmed as myself is to so totally conform to every single notion of femininity?
Yes.
Is that going to be the only way that I can conform? Which then means that, you know, one of the things that I've experienced as a transgender woman is that if I'm too feminine, I'm told that I'm a caricature, but then if I'm not feminine enough, I'm told that I'm not a real woman, right? And so it's this double standard that, again, is just this reflection of the broader policing of gender that everyone is experiencing, including all women, transgender or cisgender. And so I think it's a complicated question, and I think it's a really interesting question to delve into, but it is this I think it is illuminating of broader issues of gender policing that we experience in society.
Yes, so true. And yeah, and then it comes down to, as women, we're dinged for being ambitious.
Right.
But we don't get ahead if we don't put ourselves out there.
It's so the point you just made is one I talk about in the book too, about this notion of we require marginalized people to work 2, 3, 4 times as hard to get maybe half as far. Doing so, working that hard, requires a degree of intentionality, focus, and yes, ambition that becomes almost impossible to hide behind the false humility that we so often see of cisgender men who pretend like they don't care if they get the promotion or they don't have to advocate for themselves, or even though they're doing all of these things, they hide it behind this false humility. And when you have to work twice as hard or 3 times as hard, you can't hide that. You can't hide that determination or intentionality or focus or hard work or ambition. And so we require people to work twice as hard, and then we penalize them for working twice as hard.
Well, I'd love to talk about some of the amazing work that you've been doing in advocacy. I just, you know, I read your book, Tomorrow Will Be Different. Like, it was like this amazing adventure novel. Like, it was, I mean, it's, everything in here is real, but the way that you wrote it, I just was compelled, like, what's going to happen next?
Wow.
Is it going to happen? And part of it is because I...
Thank you.
You're welcome. I mean, part of it, I think, first of all, part of it is because it's just, it's well written, and you just, you explain things really well, and it's, anyway, it's very compelling. Part of it is that I should be more tied in with what's happening politically and where we are in terms of the laws that are being passed, but I'm not. So it was actually like a reveal in terms of what happened.
Right.
But because it was so exciting for me to read, I would love to just talk about the work that you did in Delaware.
Sure.
and how you got that done. And you can start the story anywhere you like.
Sure. So what to sort of start with one of the points you made, most people in this country think that discrimination against LGBTQ people is clearly and explicitly illegal. And while we've made pretty significant progress in making sure that existing protections based on sex do include transgender people and increasingly LGBTQ people more broadly, a majority of states in the federal government still haven't passed protections based on sexual orientation and gender identity in employment and housing in public spaces.
It's shocking.
It is shocking. I mean, 80% of the public thinks that we already have these laws because they recognize that discrimination is abhorrent. They think it's sort of foundational.
Yeah.
And they are always surprised when they learn that that's not the case. In fact, so surprised that sometimes we have to then spend some time convincing them that that's actually the reality,
right,
that these laws don't exist. But Delaware was one of those states that still did not have explicit protections for transgender people when I came out. In 2009, the state had passed protections based on sexual orientation, but did not include gender identity, which is fortunately something that does not happen anymore. We will never pass non-discrimination bills that protect a portion of the community, particularly if it's at the expense of the more marginalized portion of the community. But Delaware was one of the states that still didn't have explicit protections for transgender people. And I personally wanted to change that for myself and for other transgender people in the state. So day in and day out during my senior year in college, I went up to Delaware when I was not in class to advocate to my state legislators the need to adopt this gender identity non-discrimination bill, which would have added gender identity to Delaware's non-discrimination protections in employment, housing, public accommodations, and insurance. And at the start, I tried to approach the advocacy from a really impersonal way, just talking about statistics and facts, because I was worried that if the bill didn't pass, that I would feel rejected, that I would personally feel like this was the legislators of the state saying to me personally, since I was the one that was there the most in terms of meeting with them face to face, that this would be them saying, we don't want you, Sarah, specifically in the state. And it took me a while to get to the point where I found the courage and the confidence in my own voice to be vulnerable and to share my own story, to talk about my own experiences and my own fears. And I watched my parents connect with these legislators and could tell that I wasn't. And so it was a journey for me to recognizing that vulnerability transcends ideology. It transcends religion, race, gender, geography. Everyone understands what it feels like to be vulnerable at some point. Everyone understands what it feels like to be scared or fearful. They don't want it for themselves, and hopefully they don't want it for other people. And so for me, it was a journey through that process of finding my own voice, of finding my own story, and of finally gaining confidence in the importance of sharing my story and my experience. That advocacy, joined with so many transgender people from across the state, the equality organization, Equality Delaware, in my home state, and other national organizations like HRC coming in to support us, we were eventually able to convince enough state legislators that behind this conversation on transgender rights are real people, and that they could no longer look us in the eye and deny us the equal protection of the laws they swore to uphold. So we passed that bill in 2013 with a one vote margin of victory in the Senate, and fortunately a little bit more cushion in the House. And then it was signed into law by our state's former governor, Jack Markell, who was someone I had actually worked for in 2008 when he was elected, who was an incredible person, who is an incredible person. He's no longer governor, but he's still with us. For me, I witnessed that happen in my first year after coming out. And I think it demonstrated to me that if we can put names and faces to this issue, if we can underscore the sense of urgency, if we can demonstrate the real life consequences for so many people across this country, that I do believe we can, I think we already have a majority of this country on our side, but that we can bring enough If we have the right people in office, we can bring enough people to our side to adopt these kinds of protections across the country.
Well, I'd love to talk about your, you've referred to as your late spouse, Andy, who unfortunately passed away at a very young age from cancer. But the relationship that you describe with him in your book also seems so powerful. Like you really just nourished each other. And just, it's just such a wonderful depiction of your, the short time that you guys had together. And I just really appreciated you sharing the moments of that. And one of the things that you recount in the book is something that your brother said. Can we talk about that?
Yeah. You know, so Andy wouldn't want me to canonize him, but I will say that Andy was probably the best person that I've ever known. And I think your point of the relationship being really enriching is a really apt point. I feel like Andy and I came into each other's lives in the exact right moments. And we were there for each other in ways that I think was transformational for both of us. And I feel like I learned so much from being with Andy, both from the experiences, but also from Andy directly. After we started dating, Andy was diagnosed with cancer. He went through radiation, chemotherapy, and surgery. Got a clean bill of health a few months later, and then he got the news that every patient fears. His cancer was back. It had spread, and for him, it was terminal. When Andy didn't have much time left, he asked me to marry him. And of course, the answer was yes. 3 weeks after his diagnosis, his terminal diagnosis, we married on the rooftop of our building in front of our family and friends. And then 4 days after that, he passed away. And through it all, my brother, who is a radiation oncologist and has watched far too many people pass away, he said to me, "This is going to be incredibly difficult, but look around you and take stock in the acts of amazing grace that you will see." And I think, you know, in many ways that sort of finding beauty in tragedy, finding the light in darkness can feel like almost trite advice. Mm-hmm. But for me, it actually was eye-opening because I then started looking around and I saw truly humanity at its best. I saw people putting aside any degree of self-interest, any degree of sort of pettiness and self, you know, an ambition. I mean, it was just people coming together to truly love and support someone. And I saw miracles in the fact that our friends put together a beautiful wedding in 5 days. 5 days. It was a beautiful wedding had it been put together in 3 months, but they put together this amazing wedding in 5 days, even with all of the health scares going on.
Right, because your pragmatic approach was, we'll get someone in, we'll do the vows, we'll make it happen.
But our friends sort of came forward and they said, we want to make this as special as possible. Bishop Gene Robinson, who was the first openly gay Episcopal bishop in the world, presided and helped to sort of corral and mobilize folks. But we had friends order flowers and friends order food and friends get the decorations. It was just truly, it was a team effort. The miracle of Andy surviving to that day when, by all accounts, he probably should have passed several days before the wedding. All of these miracles, all of this amazing grace that I was able to witness, I think didn't just change my perspective in that last month, but it's totally changed my perspective in life, which is to remember that hope only makes sense in the face of hardship, and to remember that even in the darkest moments, even in the most troubling times, all of us can bear witness to acts of amazing grace. We see it every day around us, whether it's people speaking out and fighting back against injustice, whether it's people protesting and marching, whether it's people gathering around a loved one in a time of need, whether it's people accepting and embracing an LGBTQ loved one with broad smiles and open hearts, whether it's any of those acts of just basic human kindness that we see, those acts are happening all around us. And I think in many ways, that's the story of the LGBTQ community. It's the story of every single battle for civil and human rights throughout our history. It's that amazing grace, that hope in the face of hardship that only makes sense because of the heartache. That is our story. And for me, that last month of Andy's life has provided me so much courage and so much confidence and so much comfort in moving forward and to always look around to find that beauty in tragedy.
What would you like to say to parents of young trans kids?
One of the most profound points that a parent of a trans girl said to me in about their own journey was, I had to realize at a certain point whether I wanted a dead son or a living daughter. I think for any parent at the beginning of this journey, it is so important for them to understand just how important it is to love their child, to accept their child, to support their child. And I always say to parents of transgender youth who are doing that, who are doing what my parents were able to do, I always thank them for loving their child. And almost uniformly, they respond with, you shouldn't thank me. I'm just doing my job. And yes, they are. And I shouldn't. But the reality remains is that today, it is too often the exception. There are far too many families who don't do their job, who aren't doing what those parents are doing. And so I always try to thank them for loving their child.
And now it seems like we are at this intersection of youth activism and awareness and mm-hmm. better understanding of LGBTQ, and that those two things are going to come together in a really powerful movement.
I think that's right. I mean, I think throughout our history, young people have been at the forefront of change. We're certainly seeing that right now in the aftermath of Parkland, but that existed far beyond before then as well. I mean, whether it's the young people who helped lead conversations in living rooms and around dinner tables around marriage equality, whether it's the young people at the forefront of marches and protests in response to police violence or gender inequality, whether it's Marsha P. Johnson and Sylvia Rivera, who were teenagers and in their early 20s during the Stonewall Uprising, young people have always been at the forefront. And I think one of the reasons why is that, one, young people have a degree of impatience that I think all of us should feel. I'm 27, so I still think I'm young, but yeah. That everyone should feel, that everyone should feel that fierce urgency of now. And I think young people have that urgency and have that passion behind their advocacy. But I also think they're incredibly effective in their advocacy because young people speak from a place of history. And it's not the history of the past, but the history that remains to be written. Young people will be the ones that get to write the history books of tomorrow. We will get to decide who was right and who was wrong in this moment. Elected officials, the general public, they understand that. And so young people have an incredible gravity to our voice that when met with passion and urgency has made history in the past and I think will continue to make history moving forward.
What's the best advice that you've ever been given about how to approach a problem that you know needs to change, but you know in approaching it, it's going to be risky?
You know, I think everything is so individualized and everything is so unique to the circumstances that you find yourselves in that my advice to people is always, you are the best expert on who you are and what you need. And you are the best expert on how you will feel safe. You are the best expert on your well-being. You are the best expert, again, on who you are. And there's no one size fits all in these journeys. There's no one narrative. There's no one way to be you. And so I think the advice that I always have to folks, whether it's in their own journeys or whether it's in their own advocacy, is one, there's no wrong way to be you. Do what you need to do to be safe, to be healthy. And then in your advocacy also, there's no wrong way to be you. Be you in your advocacy. There's no one narrative. Don't try to feel like you need to conform your narrative or your story to what you think is either the most palatable or the most dramatic. Just allow yourself to be authentic in that advocacy because I think people will respond. But also, again, take care of yourself. Do what you will feel most safe doing, what you will feel safest doing, and listen to yourself in that journey and take the cues from yourself, not from other people.
Sarah McBride says it so well. There is no wrong way to be you. And it should be so simple, being seen and accepted for who you are. I mean, it really is a simple concept. So why does it have to be so hard to get to that point? I'd like to see a time when we can just skip the hardship and amp up the kindness. But we are not there yet. As of 2018, more than half of LGBTQ people live in states that don't protect them from discrimination or are even actively hostile toward them. Some states have enacted laws that allow businesses, healthcare providers, and government officials to actually deny services to LGBTQ people. To see your state's equality scorecard and actions you can take to advocate for anti-discrimination laws, you can visit the Human Rights Campaign website. I'll have a link to it and to Sarah McBride's book, Tomorrow Will Be Different, at inflectionpointradio.org. This is Inflection Point. I'm Lauren Schiller with stories of how women rise up. That's our Inflection Point for today. Know a woman with a great rising up story? Let us know at inflectionpointradio.org. While you're there, I invite you to become a patron of Inflection Point. Your contribution keeps women's stories front and center, and you'll be rewarded with gifts like an Inflection Point mug and EO body care. It's all on our contribute page at inflectionpointradio.org. We're on Facebook at Inflection Point Radio. You can follow me on Twitter at LA Schiller. And to find out more about the guests you heard today and sign up for our email, go to inflectionpointradio.org. Inflection Point is produced in partnership with KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco and PRX. All of our episodes are on Apple Podcasts, Radio Public, Stitcher, and NPR One. Give us a 5-star review and add us to your listening queue. Our story editor and content manager is Alora Weaver. Our engineer and producer is Eric Wayne, and I'm your host, Lauren Schiller.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.